little bit about what I've been up to is I've been fortunate to go to two conferences for students, and I've learned some interesting things about the millennial generation of libertarians. The Students for Liberty Conference is one of the world's largest libertarian student organizations. They meet in Washington, D.C., and there's, you know, dozens of vendors, thousands of students. John Stossel typically does his show there. And I went out to observe what was going on at the Washington, D.C., and I also manned the booth here in Indianapolis and saw roughly 100 Young Americans for Liberty students here in Indiana. The YAL has launched state conventions this year for the first time because they've grown as an organization rapidly. And consistently, they're seeing hundreds of people show up to these state conventions. And 2 years ago, they had their first state convention here in Indiana, and it was, I think Matt was there, it was probably 30, 40 people. And the national convention for YAL last year was in the 50s. This year, they're all across the nation, and they're seeing explosive numbers. Same with Students for Liberty, both in Washington, D.C., and in Europe. They have a Students for Liberty conference in Europe. The main reason that we're seeing an explosive number of folks in the millennial generation, which is roughly anybody who is 18 to 29 currently. So if you're 18 to 29 currently, raise your hand. All right, so there's a few of us. And the millennial generation is largely defined by 9/11. They were shaped by 9/11. So if you're at an age where that significantly impacted you and your worldview, that makes you a millennial. For instance, I was, my birthday is September 9th. I turned 18 on 9/9/2001. I signed up for Selective Service on 9/10/2001. I had a panic attack in physics class on 9/11/2001. But interestingly, our generation, even though we've spent the majority of our formative years in a time of war, only 2% of our generation actually has served in the military. If you compare that to Generation X, 6% of Generation X served in the military and are veterans. If you compare that to baby boomers, it was 16%. And it goes up to the 40s for the generation before that, from the tail end of World War II and the Korean War. So our generation, while shaped by the events of 9/11, shaped by having friends who served in the military, have not served at the levels, percentage-wise, of others. Now, that's why you see a lot of Gen Xers and a lot of folks who are in the National Guard who are having to carry the load, essentially, because our generation has not gone and served at the percentages that others have, which I think is interesting. After 9/11, after that shaping of 9/11, we went to college. Now, I distinctly remember at Plainfield being told that you're never going to get a job if you don't get a college degree. And as soon as you get your college degree, which it doesn't matter what you graduate, what degree you get, just get a degree. They didn't really tell you that. They pushed private schools. They said private schools are the way to go generally. You don't want to go to IUPUI, which is where I ended up, which was a great decision, a great school. You won't get any kind of income if you don't get a college degree. And you have to go, and it's very, very important. What they didn't tell you is that you're going to end up having roughly $100,000 worth of student loan debt. I have friends who are currently, I'd say colleges across the nation are full of students who have graduated, waited the 3 years to 4 years of deferments from your student loans. The payments came due. There are roughly $800 a month for one friend that I have, $600 for my sister, and they went back to school so they could continue to defer. So our generation is going to be very well educated, and the broke. And the reason is to defer student loan payments, but also the fact that we're largely under and unemployed. 34% of our generation cannot find a job. So you have the 9/11 attacks, you go to college, you get your degree, you get out of college, and you don't get that $60,000 a year job you were promised in high school. Makes you a little bit bitter. But despite that, our generation is largely optimistic. And researchers don't know if that is because of our youth, our youthful idiocy, or the fact that we're just a little more of an optimistic generation. Part of that is probably due to our relationship with our boomer parents. We are the... Here's the best way to describe it. Gen Xers grew up in the 70s and early 80s. And if you look at the movies about children in the 70s, it's Rosemary's Baby. It's, you are in that chair, Blanche. So that's a horror movie for you young kids. Look it up, Lauren. If you look at the movies in the 80s, there was a shift around 82 towards nannying a little bit more. And you saw a great political revolution towards it's for the children. You have helmet laws, and boomer parents during the 80s wanted to put their kids in helmets. They wanted to... that's when you see all of the... How many of you kid-proofed your house when you were parents? That really started in the 80s. You weren't able to do that in the 70s. You had to sort of make up your own devices if you wanted to kid-proof your house. I don't know why the greatest generation didn't care about their kids, but save that for another topic. You can address all letters to Maya at creatingmaya.com. And Maya will answer them appropriately. So you see the movies in the 80s, Parenthood, Three Men and a Baby. We as millennials view the family as the ultimate social safety net. So part of our optimism also comes from the fact that 1 in 8 of us will at one point in adulthood live with our parents. And probably for a while. In fact, on a totally unrelated note, I started this job living in my mom's basement. So I eventually moved out and got married and became an adult. We're late starters. Part of that is because of the delayed economy. Many of us are, the majority of our generation is under or unemployed and going back to school. So we view that safety net as part of our optimistic view. That's why the majority of our generation looks at the debt, looks at the fact that we're under or unemployed and say, it doesn't matter because 80% of our generation thinks that at some point we will have the income that we want. The needs and the wants of our lives, we will grow into that income. And I think that's pretty amazing. Now, boomers, you don't have that same view. You didn't, in fact, when you were our age, between 18 and 29. The difference in morality and moral views between boomers and millennials, the majority of millennials think that their parents' values are the correct value system. They just don't want to follow it right now. Now, you compare that to the boomers who all thought, my parents are wrong and are stupid, and now they think their millennial kids are wrong and stupid. So the boomer generation just is telling everybody what to do. And there is not a rebellious nature within the millennial psyche, but the underlying current among millennials is, will you all just get out of our way and let us fix it because you broke it? We don't hold it against you, just let us fix it because we're the ones who have to pay for it. And you really see that in the amount of millennials that are starting to run for office, that are starting to become politically active. It's why you see so many millennials joining the Libertarian Party, or are Ron Paul Republicans and, bless their hearts, joining the Republican Party to try and fix it. It wasn't that way with Gen Xers, who are a little more cynical and a little more... if you don't know if you're Gen X, if you're closer to 40, you're Gen X. So for Dan and Rob, I'm just not going to get into Gen Xers. but they're the smallest generation on the planet. Fertility rates were at an all-time low in the early 70s. And I think that's why you see the majority of this room is boomers and millennials. Just, it's a percentage thing. But we also are very comfortable working with boomers. I know that I had a great working relationship with Sam. You know, we worked well together. We got along with each other. And at my current employer, we get along great. And 75% of our generation views boomers favorably. Which, could you imagine that number in 1968 with boomers? 75% view their elders as having the correct value system, and you get along with them, you know. So what does all this mean for politics? Also, this is probably the biggest thing that I'm going to forget. The defining characteristic of boomers currently, the way they describe themselves as their outstanding characteristics, hard work and respect. What happened to you people between 1968 and now? Hardworking and respectful. I don't think you would have said that in 1970. The defining characteristic of millennials is that technology can solve any problem. We view technology as a means to fix society's ills. And because of 9/11, because it was an activating moment for many of us, we are the most charitable, and we would rather work in meaningful causes. And that's why you see a growth in nonprofits and political careers. Political science is now the number one reason that millennials get a degree. It's overtaken, I forget what that other boring job was. But political science is now the number one degree that college students get. And I feel that way too. I was willing to live in my mom's basement to work in a career that I felt was going to be meaningful for society at large, because I think I can change it. we'll see in 20 years if that's the case. So we believe that technology and the use of technology is incredibly important, and that's why you see an emphasis in technology for us. And part of it is because for Gen Xers and baby boomers, The place that you would hang out with your friends was in the mall. Mallrats, for instance, was a movie for you young kids that discussed that. If you look at the 80s movies, people hung out in the mall, or they hung out at restaurants or coffee shops. We hang out on Facebook. The majority of us spend... for instance, I was in Washington, D.C. at SFL. I was by myself. I didn't have anybody with me. I ended up in a hipster bar in Washington, D.C., and I just put on Facebook that I was in a hipster bar, and I had a conversation with my friends back in Indianapolis. So while I was physically alone, I was engaged with my friends online having a conversation. And that's why it's incredibly important for politicians, candidates, political parties to engage this largest generation that is very libertarian-leaning online. Part of the reason that there is a bent towards libertarianism amongst millennials is cultural influences. People like Howard Stern, South Park, you know, these are the things that we watched. We saw many of the movies that came out were libertarian. So we're very culturally libertarian, which led to a political libertarianism. And the spark that lit the brush fire was Ron Paul's candidacy in 2008. And having that platform to talk about non-interventionism, because we all had a personal connection with someone who was at war, while we may not have served in the numbers in the past, we knew people from our high school that had passed away or were serving in the military. Economic non-interventionism, the message of prosperity, speaks to a generation that is largely unemployed or underemployed. College debt is one of the highest polling issues for college students. So even libertarian students will say the federal government has got to do something about student debt. And largely, they understand that the federal government broke it. I mean, the reason student debt and the reason that immigration are broken is because the federal government runs it. So we want to see change. We want to see action. The reason that you see a personal shift towards personal liberty, for instance, is cultural influences like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, like Will and Grace. So these cultural influences, it starts with that. They hear the message through Ron Paul. Now, the thing that happened between 2008 and 2012 is that many of these students who were influenced by Ron Paul, the majority of them were in high school or they were just starting college, and then they started to organize on campus. Well, it just kind of got flabby, for lack of a better term, for a lot of these college students after Ron Paul dropped out of the race. But Rand Paul's filibuster has galvanized these students like you would not believe. They are organizing at an even faster rate, an even faster pace, because it's the worst-kept secret in the libertarian movement that Rand Paul will run for president in 2016, and that they have kept all of Ron Paul's organization going so he can run in 2016. So where does that leave us? They are, Rand Paul's a Republican. We're the Libertarian Party. There is something interesting that I've noticed in these students when I see them at the YAL or I talk with them. You know, we do a podcast and run a website here in Indiana called WeAreLibertarians.com. And it is based for millennials. It's, you know, who's your millennials who are libertarians? There's about 15 of us that write on the blog and several of us that do podcasts and talk about politics. So we are constantly talking about our favorite subject, which is us, and what makes us tick. And the thing that I have noticed is that they do not care about structures. Okay, the millennial generation is a religious. Their religiosity is the same as other generations. In fact, abortion rates, drug use, alcohol abuse, spousal abuse, violent crimes have dramatically dropped within the millennial generation compared to the boomer generation, which spiked. So the millennial generation is a very values-oriented generation, but they don't go to religious organizations. They believe in some spiritual being. Yet 24% believe that I'm sure there's something out there, but I'm just not going to take the time to figure it out, which is a high watermark. But that other 76%, or whatever the other part of 24% is, believe that there is. I wasn't good at math. You didn't hire me because I was good at math. Matt Whitliff knows that all too well now. They are values-oriented. These things that are considered sinful are dropping, even though it seems like these darn kids these days are just running wild and doing things with everybody and everything. So it's not the case. The problem for religious institutions is that they don't join religious institutions. They don't want to be part of a religion. They want a faith system, but not a religion. In politics, it's exactly the same. These libertarian kids that I see at SFL and I see at YAL, they don't care about a political party. They don't care about the Republicans. The Republican Party and the Libertarian Party are an ends to a means. They will abandon any institution as fast as it starts to contradict their values. Okay? They care about individual candidates. So if Ron Paul and Rand Paul were Libertarian Party members, they would follow them. If they were Democrats, they would follow them. If they were Libertarians or Republicans, they would follow them. They don't care about political structures. They care, and I think that's why you see, gosh, half of our candidates last year were millennials, but I don't know that we have any millennial county chairs. Travis Wyke. Travis may be the only one. They don't care about political structures. They care about candidates that reflect their values. And you see that in a Rupert left-leaning candidacy and an Andy Horning right-leaning candidacy. You had two different sets of volunteers for those campaigns. They were millennials. There wasn't much crossover, yet they voted for each other's campaigns. And they picked the candidate based on what they felt their values were and what candidate reflected their values. So I think that speaks to the importance of trying to recruit candidates from a broad spectrum, take the foundational libertarian principles, find candidates that reflect those principles, that talk about issues through those principles, because this generation is well-educated, well-read, and well-trained. The college kids that I see at FSL and YAL are fluent in Mises, fluent in Hayek. Creighton is 22 and knows more about libertarian thought than the majority of people in this room, probably. And I don't mean that as a slam. It's just that he is a super nerd about Misesian economics, Austrian economics. But he is also a very personable person. He has taken that and he applies that in a way that the majority of people would understand. And the reason is because he's gone to almost every YAL, SFL, Advocates, Leadership Institute training that he can get to. They train them in messaging. They train them in campaigns. They train them in grassroots organizing. The YAL kids and the SFL kids, the college groups right now probably go to 3 to 5 training events a year, at least, in both messaging, campaigning, and grassroots activism. And a lot of that is because the Koch brothers are funding these organizations like the Koch Institute, the Leadership Institute, YAL's work, I don't think SFL. The Koch brothers, for whatever you think about them, they are responsible for the majority of the funding for training this grassroots group of libertarian kids. You know, is the Cocteopus infiltrating the libertarian movement? Absolutely. Is that money being spent on training and educating a heck of a lot of college students? Yeah. And they're going to make a difference because they think they can. So I'll let you make a judgment one way or the other. I mean, I have my opinion on it, but so they're going to apply their libertarian principles and their training towards candidates that reflect their values. You know, as far as party structures, because it is such a big generation, you will see millennials grow into county chairs. And, you know, gosh, if you look at our central committee, we had Jeremiah, Joe Ruiz were on central committee. You know, we did have our share of state party leadership. So you will get county chairs and political structure, but I think the most important takeaway from what I've seen in the libertarian movement is to find candidates that discuss principles in an easily accessible way and don't just stick to one type of libertarianism. Try to reach out to a broad spectrum of libertarians because they're wanting to vote for us. They want us to get our act together. They may just not be willing to become 1994 Society members yet, but that's just because they have no money. And by the way, I'd like to say, I hope you all noticed my pen, so stop chasing me with yellow cards. I joined. So I'd like to open it up to any questions. Do you have any questions that about anything that I've seen through some of these organizations and characteristics?
Yeah, I was just at a conference for work 2 weeks ago, and I can't remember the gentleman who was a speaker. He's an author who's been writing all sorts of stuff on this, but he wrote the book Growing Up Digital, and he spent a lot of the time in the session talking about the millennials and their use of technology. So I'd just like to throw that at you a little bit and talk a little bit about what you're seeing on that side, because this generation, from the day they were old enough to do anything, they've had computers.
Right? Sure. We are going to be a weird generation because we were trained fully in the old systems of research. We remember using a catalog. I do. I don't know about some of the younger millennials, but I think the majority of millennials remember using a card catalog system in a library and understanding, putting our hands on a book and researching. Lauren says she doesn't,
no,
but she's about 8-9 years younger than I am.
I'm not. I'm 4.
4 years younger?
I'm 4 years younger.
How old are you?
I'm 24.
Oh, okay. I thought you were younger. that wasn't a joke.
I know I look 17.
But we are fluent in the old research methods. We were not born and immersed like the generation behind us, Generation Z. We were not immersed in technology and social media and all that. We started out on, what was the Commodore 64s and the Apple Lisas and playing Oregon Trail. If you ever want to make a millennial laugh, make an Oregon Trail joke. That's just the first connection you can make. We've grown up with technology, and we are quick adopters. It's hard to think of Facebook being, 5 years old?
Six.
But the majority of people have probably had it 4 years. And look how fast it changes. There is a constant changing. This came out 4 years ago, an iPhone. In high school, the Motorola Razr was like the phone to have. Now if you have a Motorola Razr, okay, somebody call the police. we're very quick about adopting technology and leveraging technology and understanding technology. That's why most offices like to have a millennial around so they can fix their boss's email. They understand the changing trends, and technology is like we don't look at Facebooking on our phone at dinner as a cultural taboo, because we're probably talking to you while you're sitting at the table through Facebook, and having a conversation. We don't view it as an alternative to conversation. We view it as a supplement to conversation with each other. There's a very rarefied air of people who are blazing technology trails and creating Facebooks and creating BuzzFeeds and new ways of communicating. But the rest of the generation goes, oh, that's cool, I'll try it. I want my content wherever I want it, whenever I want it. If you go on any digital platform or social media and look up We Are Libertarians, you'll find it. Because that's a great way to advertise. Because you don't know who you're going to catch on Pinterest. You don't know who you're going to catch on Twitter. It's totally different audiences. So you've got to be casting a net in as many places as possible. Because the old model of walking into the office the next day and saying, did you see MASH last night? That doesn't exist anymore. It's, look at the numbers for the people that watch the Super Bowl. It's still not, it's maybe what? A third of the people of the nation that watch it. We don't have those big cultural events anymore. They're very different. And when they do happen, we go to Twitter to talk to each other about it. So you've got to cast that net out. What else? Okay. Lauren.
I'm fortunate enough to be friends with some of the people of my generation on Facebook.
That sounded sarcastic.
I say that sarcastically.
Right.
A lot of them don't care about what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They have their budge or change on it. How can we reach out to a generation that seems apathetic to these ideas while keeping the people interested that are interested in it? So keeping those two levels.
I think you have to look at it the way that we've always looked at it, which is sinners, salvageables, and saints. There are the saints that are just going to get it right away and get involved and work. And then there are the salvageables who you can reason with and have a conversation with and convert them to your way of thinking. And then there are the sinners, the people that are just not worth your time arguing about. I mean, the people who are so immersed in the housewives of Carmel culture they on BET who are not politically interested, their main political argument is who's better, Kim or Chloe. You're just not going to reach those people. So why bother? They may, over time, develop, once they start getting real paychecks, become a little more politically interested. You look at the development of a generation, just the fact that the main outlook on their own generation, the boomers think hard work and respect are their two main valuable characteristics. That's quite a growth over 40 years, 30 years. So our generation may progress into a more politically active generation because there are so many of us who are. And when we're politically active, all I want to do and all she wants to do is make a difference and change the world. Sam.
The past two election cycles, a major dilemma across the whole Libertarian Party has been, how do we reach out and how do we acquire those people who are in Ron Paul Popes mm-hmm. and now are going to be apparently shifting their allegiances to his son, Rand Paul, who's nowhere near as good a libertarian as his father was.
Sure.
Assuming in 2016 that the Republicans do the same thing to Rand Paul that they did to Ron Paul over the past two election cycles, what plans can we start putting in place now to reach out to those younger people that are supporting him or would support him to, after the disastrous convention in August of 2016, where they don't even let his delegates into the convention again? What can we start pre-planning now, and not just as a state party, but as a national party?
Let's think about Barry Goldwater in 1964. Because I think everyone in this room should study Barry Goldwater in 1964 a little bit. Because I think Rand Paul, as much as we all think he's eloquent and wonderful at speaking, I think he could be a complete Goldwater moment for the Republican Party and for the Libertarian movement, which set the Libertarian movement back in the public's mind initially, but it planted all those seeds of the people that, like David Nolan, the people that founded and grew the Libertarian Party initially. So no matter what happens with Rand Paul in the Republican Party, that's almost, you don't want to go out there and fight that, because all Rand Paul is doing is helping. He's planting seeds. He's the reason these kids are getting trained, the reason these kids are learning Austrian economics and political theory and libertarian philosophy and arguing with their idiot Obama friends. If Rand Paul gets elected and he becomes president for 8 years, great. That does nothing to hurt the Libertarian Party. Because at some point, the Republican Party and the political establishment and the Democrats are going to expunge and expel the Rand Paul Republicans like they did with the Goldwater conservatives. And where is the home that they will eventually land? Right here. We're here because Goldwater conservatives got purged by the Nixonians and they created the Libertarian Party. So it may not be easy for a Libertarian Party to accept the fact that the highest profile libertarian, in quotes, is a Republican right now. But it's not going to stay that way forever. So keep the structure going. Keep your people trained. Recruit candidates. There were a lot of people who were working for Andy Horning and Rupert Bonham and voting for those two candidates who were also Ron Paul voters. The millennial generation is party agnostic. They don't care. So as long as your candidates are reflecting their values, they will come to the Libertarian Party and give you votes. It is all about the candidates. It is not about the party structure. For millennials, is an ends to a means. So you have to have ballot access. You have to have county parties. You want to cast your net out as far as you possibly can and reflect those libertarian principles. But you want to promote your candidates as much as possible. You know, one thing is one of the reasons we started the We Are Libertarians podcast with myself, Chris Galt, and Creighton Harrington a year ago, and March 8th was the one-year anniversary. And when I was at YAL, I had an equal amount of kids who are Rand Paul Republicans who are going to GOP meetings right now come up and say, I listened to the podcast, I voted for libertarian candidates, you know, as they talk to me about anything else. I mean, and it's just because you're connecting with them in a way that is not, like, there's certain stereotypes about libertarians. And, yeah. And the three of us didn't fit those stereotypes. And don't, you know. And so it was a way for us to put a face on, and still on, the Libertarian Party of Indiana that is positive and optimistic. You know, one of our guiding philosophies is that we're not going to have a red and a yellow and a black banner all across the site, and we're going to talk about the cabal and proletariat and, you know, all these words that Lou Rockwell uses. That doesn't win over converts at all. We're going to talk about the hope of America and how we can change it and how we can make it better. And optimism is huge. If you're not optimistic as a party, if you're not having people walk out of this door feeling good about their accomplishments, then they're not coming back. And that is, doesn't matter what generation it is. So it really is incumbent upon the party structure, every leader, every person in this room, to be as optimistic as possible and point out the good things and not the bad things. And there's self-criticism that must take place, but don't let it be your focus. Wes, I saw Wes first.
Sort of maybe piggybacking on that answer, like for me, coming from a millennial perspective, growing up, going to the internet and seeing all these very, very nice looking cool sites, you know, Facebook's out design, Twitter, all those things look nice, they look cool. And then I go to that LPIN page, and our designs kind of look like they were made in the 90s. And I guess, piggybacking on that answer, how do you think, is there any rebranding that the LP needs to do to better appeal to millennials?
When I started in 2008, we had a website. It was the older website. We didn't have a Facebook presence. We didn't have a Twitter presence. We weren't on YouTube. And with over the last 3 years, you look at our numbers, that's the growth. I mean, if your first contact with the LPIN was Facebook, raise your hand. Someone on Facebook, not just the party, but yeah. I mean, and it's just a way to go out and connect with people. And, you know, we built that website in 2009. And it was...
I didn't mean to criticize.
Yeah, you're a real jerk. That's... I'm not making fun of your hipster beard or anything, but you're making fun of my website. No, I know. Matt and I have talked about this. The website is due for a facelift because it was built in 2009. You know... Yeah, that's how fast things move. We launched We Are Libertarians in January with a look. We just redid the entire look of the website in 3 months because it just was like, well, this isn't right, so let's fix it. You know, it is a constant updating progress. And the Libertarian Party of Indiana website, I think, is due for an upgrade, and it's something that we talked about before we left. It's just... In 2012, what was the focus? Was it answering candidate questions? Was it fundraising? Or was it rebuilding a website? And I think this year is the perfect year when you don't have candidates to focus on that. One of the problems that I have seen across the libertarian movement is that you're almost going to have to pay for it if you want it to look right. Plain and simple. You know, your cousin's brother is not going to design a website that is going to be visually appealing and attractive to people. You're going to have to pay for it. And it could be $4,000 to $5,000 for a fully functioning website that looks good. The other problem with our system is that we have other county parties dependent on our web system, but that's just a matter of updating templates. And I think that's why most libertarian websites look bad. They just want to find somebody who knows how to do websites, but you need... No, I'm saying a WordPress would work. You need a template. It's the graphic design behind it that takes skill and talent. And the reason our website looks like it's outdated in the 90s is because I'm not a graphic designer, but I didn't have a budget to hire one, so I did it and figured it out. I remember in 2008 when I was hired, I remember saying to Dan, like, here, Dan, listen, I don't know HTML code. I don't want to learn. I will update the website, but like, don't expect me to learn all this web stuff. I'm now doing websites freelance currently because the last 4 years I've figured out how to do web development and graphic design, and I'm doing freelance websites. So, you know, we've kind of come a long way where we're at on the web presence, but I think it's time to take a look at figuring out how to pay somebody to do it. So, Drew.
To that point, do you have any thoughts on millennials and fundraising?
Millennials are not going to like this answer. Get a list on a spreadsheet, pick up the phone and call. As much as we'd like things like Blue Swarm to fundraise on Facebook for us, the way that we raise money is picking up the phone and calling and asking, and then calling back and thanking them. That's just always going to be that way because it's a social faux pas to send somebody a Facebook message and say, give me $50. So, Michael.
What do you think about crowdsourcing? It seems to work pretty well.
I love it. I mean, I think the LPIN Facebook group, although there are times where I hate seeing the sausage making because I don't have to anymore, I think the conversation amongst leadership in the LPIN Facebook group, I think a lot of that is crowdsourcing. You know, there is a wisdom in crowds, and the more people you can get involved in sharing their opinions and then filter that down into strategies, you just have to have somebody at the end of the day say, okay, that's enough discussion, let's do this. Let's make a decision. And I think both Sam did a great job of that, and Dan will too.
Well, Chris, when you approached me about the Winston State Building Center, mm-hmm. I was not real positive about it, was I?
No, you were a pain in the butt. Right.
Go out and raise it yourself, and I'll be more than happy, and staff yourself, and I'll be more happy to sign off on everything.
Right.
How long did it take you to raise $2,000?
2 days.
And how did you do it?
Because Mark Rutherford and I picked up the phone call and called and asked people $50, $100 at a time. And we paid for it in 2 days because we picked up the phone and called and asked people. We had a reason people were giving money. We shared the value of donating the money, and I think we showed results. I think it was extremely beneficial for us. I mean, anytime 7,000 people come through your booth, they stand there for 20 minutes, and then you get me or Jeff Spoonamore walking up to you going, you want to take the quiz? No? Here's my baby Audrey. You want to do it for her? He'd get them every single time. Audrey is the greatest salesman libertarians have.
You mentioned that, you know, it's okay if people go and vote Rand Paul in 2016 and if he wins again in 2020. And then if that happens, you know, eventually all those millennials are going to come back probably to the Libertarian Party anyway, mm-hmm. because Republicans are going to push them out. If something like that happens, you're looking at 2024 before that time. And, you know, looking at the boomer generation, the 60s versus the 80s, they were completely different people.
Mm-hmm.
Completely. You know, they went from hippies, anti-war protesting, to we own the big corporations and we're Reagan Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
What's to say that the millennials are still going to be the same people in 2024? And if not, where is their path? Where will they be?
The number one, the head of the College Republicans in 1964, there's footage of this person working in the basement of the RNC headquarters because he was a diehard libertarian Goldwater conservative. He was in the basement churning out college students across the nation for Barry Goldwater. The man was Karl Rove. So you're not going to get everybody. Second is we've got to be patient. You know, there is always that impulse that this isn't happening fast enough. Well, I know everything is supposed to happen as fast as possible, when we want it, how we want it. That is a characteristic of all three generations represented in this room. Why do we have to wait for it? I can get it on Facebook in 5 minutes. Well, building a political party is long, tough. Managing personalities, it's difficult. It's going to take some time. And you just do what you can do, which is putting out the candidates that you think are going to connect with voters and reflect libertarian principles. Lauren?
I know you were talking earlier about how our generation is the generation that wants to advocate and do things and make a change in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would it be good to try and see if we can get some of those people involved in like leadership positions in the party? Do you think that might change their mind about a party? Is feeling like that party allows them to
sure.
do things other parties won't do?
That's
what brought me.
Right. Ownership means that they take responsibility and that they want to do better. Ownership is always a good thing. Last question. Anybody? Darlene.
With many of the things you've been saying are just right on target, and I just really would like to validate that, you know, you're saying what I've been saying for years.
Thank you.
And it's great to have a son that I can say is an adopted son.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I look at you and I look around at the growth that's happening between my kids, my grandkids, etc. There's a factor that I keep harping on all of these years is libertarianism is a philosophy, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And so if we're waiting for a political party to do this, it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It happens day in and day out by you living libertarian philosophy, building your businesses, doing your learning processes. These are where we can encourage these activities to go on, is to apply the philosophy in your day-to-day life.
When I sat down to write the fundamentals of what libertarian philosophy is, and it's 2 pages in a Word document in Times New Roman 12, the only political aspect of our foundational principles was limited government, and that's it. And the rest of it is social philosophy and the golden rule. And, you know, the morals were ringing in my ears the whole time. You live the libertarian lifestyle. And if you want things to change, you have to start with yourself. You have to start with your dealings with other people, your voluntary interaction with others. And through that example, other people will go, wow, he's really honest. You know, so I think it's a social philosophy as well as a political philosophy. Final thought, I want to thank Alyssa and Lauren for the hard work that they put in this week. They're fantastic. Lauren was my intern. She, you know, we tease her mercilessly, but it's only because we like her so much. And I think she's got the skills, and I think moving forward, working with Dan, I think she's only going to get even better. Alyssa has experience running nonprofits. She's come in, and she's just really owned it. I put 30-40% of the work into these conventions in the past 4 years. I don't think I got a phone call once asking about the convention, because the two of them together were able to just get it. They get it right away. So being staff sometimes is not always the most thankful job, so please do everything you can to emphasize the positive, give them positive feedback, and remember that one negative comment means you have to now give 5 compliments to make up for it. So make sure you thank them and tell them when they do a good job. So thank you all for humoring me for a while, and thank you for the opportunity to come and serve you for the last 4 years.